Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Great to have you here. Great to have you here. We are coming up at 6:05. I want to let you know, remind you, we've got Burton and Nita Folsom, their book, FDR Goes to War. We're going to have them for the whole hour. You're not going to want to miss it. You are going to learn a lot. You're going to want to buy their book. Go to Amazon.com, check out FDR Goes to War. And at 7:05, Victor Davis Hanson, you probably know who he is, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution out at Stanford, and just an incredible mind, one of the great thinkers and writers in America today. We're very lucky to have him. Again, our phone number here in the studio, 303-696-1971. My email, ross@backboneradio.net. And you can shoot me an instant message from my website. If you go over to rossbutin.com, there's a little box over on the right side, and you can send me a message. Joined in studio by my friend Fred. And before we move on to the canon law thing, you know, I just want to do just a little bit more politics. We've talked a little about Romney and Santorum. Let's just do a few seconds on the remaining candidates in the Republican side of the race. So let's start with Ron Paul. And you know what? Why don't you go first, Fred? What's your take on Ron Paul?
You know, I love Ron Paul. I actually voted for him a long time ago when he was running as a libertarian. The problem I have with Ron Paul and the reason why I can't support him today is because of his foreign policy approach. The world is just way too dangerous for us to completely disengage and step back from and follow his advice. So I like Ron Paul. He's a great guy. I actually believe he's one of the few guys who really is consistent, really tells it like it is, like he's thinking it, but he's just wrong on foreign policy.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I guess what I'd say is that he's not just wrong, but he's dangerously wrong. As you said, his view, there are very few legitimate functions of the federal government. Most of what the federal government does today, it shouldn't be doing. But one of the few legitimate functions of the federal government is national defense, national security, and just pretending that there are, you know, that the Muslim lunatics out there don't want to hurt us, or that the reason that they want to hurt us is because we have soldiers on the ground somewhere, is borderline suicidal, and I just can't go there, even though, like you, I really appreciate Ron Paul's consistent references to the Constitution on domestic policy and that sort of thing. So let's move on to Newt Gingrich. Again, you go first.
He's a very smart guy. He's taken on a number of very problematic positions in his past. He's had a number of very problematic things going on with his life that might make me question his judgment. He's apologized for it. He's made reference to the fact that he's gotten past it. And I'm the kind of guy that tends to forgive people when they actually admit their mistakes. But I think his time has come and passed, and I don't think he's going anywhere.
And then finally, and this could be the shortest discussion of all, but any thoughts on John Huntsman?
I just don't know the guy all that well, and I think that's a problem.
Yeah, I don't think he's got the money or organization to go anywhere. You know, there's an argument to be made that Huntsman has maybe the best economic strategy, the best economic policy positions of any of the Republican candidates, but how many people actually know that? How many people know anything that Huntsman believes? It's a big problem for Huntsman. And another big problem for Huntsman is that I think it's not that easy for him to make a serious contrast with Mitt Romney, because they're both relatively good-looking, very rich, Mormon former governors. And so, you know, if elections are about contrast, it's not going to be that easy for John Huntsman to make a contrast. Still, you know, there's a chance he'll come in second in New Hampshire, and that'll probably be the last you really ever hear of him. All right, let's switch gears here, and I'll just give my predictions. I think Romney wins New Hampshire by 15 to 20 points, and I actually do think Romney wins South Carolina, and that'll basically be the end of it. But then 10 days after South Carolina is Florida. If Romney wins that, it's over. And so, and I think that's what's going to happen. I think Romney's going to go through the whole thing. And I think Republicans, conservative Republicans or libertarian leaning Republicans, are just going to have to say, look, you know, this is our horse now. Are we going to, you know, are we going to ride him, or are we going to just let Barack Obama have four more years? And I just don't see Republicans giving Obama four more years, even if they don't love Romney.
And I know you and I have talked about this. I voted for third-party candidates in the past when I was really not happy with what the Republicans were putting forward, and I'm just done with that. The damage and the harm that another 4 years of the kind of nominations to the Supreme Court that Barack Obama might make is just far too much for me to accept. So I'm going to vote for the Republican nominee. I'll bet it's going to be Mitt Romney.
Would you vote for the Republican nominee if it were Ron Paul?
Ooh.
Because I probably
that's a tough one.
I might not.
I probably would not. That's a good call.
And I'm sure you and I are probably not exactly on the same page on this one, but I'd have a very hard time voting for Rick Santorum.
I could vote for Rick Santorum. As I said, the biggest thing I have with Rick Santorum is it's hard for me to forgive him for having thrown his principles aside in the past and never looked back and apologized for it or admitted a mistake.
I think you, more people probably think like you do than like I do on Santorum, and I'm not sure I could ever vote for the guy. I really don't like how he wants to jam his morality down our throats with the federal government, and I'm not gonna go down that road.
But I think if you listen carefully to what he says, you'll find that his position is one of actually getting the federal government out of a lot of the issues that it's now in, because we have bad cases like Roe v. Wade.
Yes, except that he talks about all kinds of things that he wants the federal government to do when it comes to education and stuff that, you know, should be required for kids and various mandates and all this, you know, a lot of child raising stuff, where it's very, you would think that a conservative would want to stay away from any federal involvement in that, and yet there he is.
Yeah,
I can
probably agree with you on that.
We'll see. So let's do a few minutes here on canon law, because I think it's really interesting that you went and got this canon law degree for fun, to serve the church. So basically, it's the law of the Catholic Church at this point, and it lets you be involved in matters where members of the church have a conflict with the church that is under the jurisdiction of church law. Is that right?
Well, arguably, even among themselves. But I actually want to take a step back and talk about canon law. I mentioned earlier that it's the oldest continuously running legal system in the world. The reality is that canon law is extremely important to all of us because it's the foundation for all modern legal systems. If you look at a lot of the things that we take for granted, such as the presumption of innocence, there's this myth that the presumption of innocence really came from English law, was really introduced as part of the Magna Carta. There's nothing that could be further from the truth. The reality is that the presumption of innocence came out of canon law in the 12th century and was actually pulled by the canon lawyers of the 12th century right out of scripture. And I'll ask you a question. Do you know what the very first recorded trial in the history of the universe is?
I have no idea. I mean, I would have guessed something out of Plato or Socrates.
Well, it's much earlier than that. We're talking Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and the original sin.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if you
look at... Was there a presumption of innocence there?
There was, and that's where it was pulled out. So here you have God, who's the judge, and he's omniscient, so he knows everything. And in spite of this, he's giving Adam and Eve a trial. He goes out and he summons Adam. He's walking and he says, Adam, where are you? And gives Adam a chance to explain himself. Now, Adam fumbles and basically says, it was your fault, God, because it was the woman you gave me that did it. And then there's another legal concept that is introduced because the woman brings in the serpent. So you have the legal concept of joinder. And all these scriptural references that were pulled into Western legal thought in the 12th century have continued to exist and continue to influence the law that we have now and that we take for granted. So I think canon law is extremely important for us as members of Western civilization to set us apart, to say that, look, we have a system of laws that respects and is based on some fundamental rights, including the presumption of innocence, including the ability to have multiple witnesses. I think there's a passage in Deuteronomy, and I don't remember which one it is, that actually lays that out as a fundamental part of conducting trials. And our Western legal tradition is based on these very important facts. And I think that today, as a Western society, we're threatened by alternatives, I'll call them that, from other traditions that are inferior. And I think we need to recognize where our legal systems come from, where our rights come from, so that we can vindicate them, defend them, and understand them.
303-696-1971, our number here in the studio. I like that you said that, you know, some of these systems that are trying to challenge us are inferior and not just alternative, because I agree with you. Are you thinking of Sharia when you say that? What do you have in mind?
Well, I think that I wasn't specifically thinking of Sharia, because to be really honest, I'm not an expert on Sharia, so I really ought not to comment on it. But I will say that some of the things that I am hearing about from some countries that are under Sharia law, what I read about in the news about the lack of due process, the lack of the ability to defend oneself, the infringements on freedom, are very troubling to me. But I'm also seeing a troubling trend in the West, where we seem to be moving away from some of our old traditions and basically saying law is whatever we want it to be, rather than recognizing the fact that there are fundamental natural laws that are part of who we are as human beings, that are part of this Western tradition, that really need to be protected and respected.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about canon law and the difference between canon law, the law of the church, and civil law, civil and criminal law that we live under, you know, in a regular society. I think it's a fascinating conversation. If you want to join it, 303-696-1971. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. Ross Kaminsky, joined by my friend Fred, not using last names today. Well, for my guest. And we're talking about canon law, which is the law of the Catholic Church, versus civil law. And I want to sort of drift over here a little bit into the area of marriage. And it reminded me of a topic that I wanted to bring up, which is the other day, State Senator Kevin Lundberg, this was on Friday, State Senator Kevin Lundberg pulled a bill that he had planned on introducing in the state, Colorado State Legislature, and the bill, which he called the Parental Divorce Reduction Act, is legislation that, by Lundberg's own description, that would require 6 hours of instruction on how divorce affects children and a waiting period of about 8 months before a married couple who have underage children could proceed with divorce under Colorado law. And there were going to be exceptions for physical abuse, drug and alcohol addictions, and long-term incarceration of a spouse, whatever that means exactly. And then, in any case, the pushback against this was huge, with a lot of people, including many conservatives, wondering, you know, how is someone a limited government conservative if they're going to propose a bill like that? And so on Friday, I guess Lundberg decided he had heard enough, and he pulled the bill, and so it's not going forward. And it's kind of interesting within the context of Kevin Lundberg saying that he is going to try to run for Congress, to run against Jared Polis in the 2nd Congressional District, which includes Boulder. So I think he probably realized it was a very bad political move for him. So, Fred, first, any thoughts on the idea of that legislation?
Yeah, I want to actually take it a step back, and what I want to talk about is, I think, a misunderstanding of what marriage is from a legal historical perspective, and your eyes may glaze over, but you and I have had the conversation where you view marriage as fundamentally a contract between two people, and that was a very old, it's the ancient Roman view of marriage as a contract with some specific characteristics. But sometime, again, during the revival of Roman law and the development of the common law in Europe, it was recognized that marriage is actually a public contract. So it's a unique contract between the couple that is getting married and the government. And the couple is basically agreeing to do certain things in exchange for a certain preferential treatment by the government. So the couple has an obligation to remain married, to produce and raise offspring, which are valued by the state. And that's really the origin of the civil understanding of marriage, starting from, say, the 13th, 14th century on, with some roots earlier than that. So if you look at that perspective, then divorce, something like no-fault divorce, really makes very little sense, because no-fault divorce really brings the contract back to a Roman understanding of marriage as a contract, where two people who are in the contract simply agree to separate, and the state, which is a party to the contract under more modern legal theories, then steps back and says, I don't care about it. And I think that's fundamentally a flawed model.
Well, yeah, I mean, you and I disagree on this, right? I mean, I just don't think it's – once you start letting the government – have any involvement like that in people's personal lives, I just don't know where you stop drawing those lines.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of letting the government. I think it's you're not obligated to be married. If you want to take advantage of this public construct, then you accept the rules that the state imposes on it. You're not, there's no obligation for you to
Well, so just for example, you know, where do you draw the line in terms of government getting involved, such as with tax deductions for having kids? And now Rick Santorum, actually one of the things Rick Santorum is proposing is increasing the amount of tax deduction that people with kids can get. So it's basically a subsidy from people who don't have kids or people who have a small number of kids to people who have more kids. And I have kids, but I don't like that at all.
Yeah, but I have five kids, right? So, but separate the issue of federal versus state. Marriage is not a federal issue. So let's take the federal government off the table. Now, should the state governments be involved in that? Absolutely. If the states believe that their welfare requires incentivizing more children, I think that's certainly a tool they should consider. I mean, Europe is dying right now because their reproduction rate is below the replacement rate, and they have a pyramid scheme of social programs that are going to collapse. And a lot of European countries are creating incentives for people to have more children, I should add, with very limited success. So I think there certainly can be a public interest in creating incentives for people to have children.
And I'm still not convinced. I still think that once you – I mean, okay, so then where do you draw the line in terms of – some politician might think that some other thing is worth incentivizing, and then some other thing is worth incentivizing, and then you have...
Isn't what local politics is all about, is you have these debates, and you have a marketplace of ideas, and you have regulation. And the beautiful thing about the United States is that we have 50 laboratories where different ideas can be tried out and tested, and you see which ones are successful.
Right, but you're also then... You're also... talking about, you're saying that it should be up to local politics and local debates where, you know, how to transfer money from one citizen to another because some politician or group of politicians gets elected that wants to incentivize a certain thing. I mean, so okay, it's marriage and having more kids. So we want to incentivize having more kids. But then what's next? What would we want to incentivize, you know, having greener grass in the yards or having whatever? Where does it end?
Well, I'm a big fan of limited government, but I think that within that limit there has to be a debate, and I think the limits are set by those absolute rules that I mentioned earlier that are founded in our fundamental rights, that are based on natural law, that are ensconced in our constitutions, both state and federal, that establish limits. And the beautiful thing about having a federal system is that I will argue very vigorously against the growth of even state government, but if I should lose that argument, I will move to a state that has much more limited government. And you know, I've done that. I used to live in California, and at one point in my life, I said I've had enough, and I moved to Virginia.
Yep, you did. I've done a similar thing. I'm actually moved out of the country when Bill Clinton raised taxes. So I'm on the same page with you there. All right, we're going to have to leave that topic there, but you're certainly an articulate spokesman for your side of the argument, which I appreciate. Now, look, when we come back, We're going to have Bert and Anita Folsom from Hillsdale College. They've written a book, FDR Goes to War. Go to Amazon.com, put in the search box, FDR Goes to War. You're going to love this conversation. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to want to buy the book. It's going to be absolutely great. We're going to have them for a full hour. Call if you have any questions. I know lots of you out there are history buffs, have heard a lot about FDR. You want to know what's true, what's not true. So let us know, you know, join the conversation, 303-696-1971. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio on News Talk 710 KNUS and 1460 KZNT. We'll be right back with Bert and Anita Folsom.